In the name of God, the beneficent, the merciful, the creator and the sustainer of the universe, peace and blessings upon his messenger and servant, Muhammad forever, Amin. I bear witness that there is no deity worthy of worship except for the one God, and I bear witness that Muhammad is the messenger and slave servant of God. To all of the viewers of the Islam and Focus program, I greet you with the universal greetings of peace, the greeting that has been used by all the prophets from Abraham to Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, assalamu alaikum, which means peace be unto you. This is the Islam and Focus program. I'm your host, Hamad Rashid. In today's program, we start our seventh in the series dealing with the pillars of Islam. And today we'll be talking about the third pillar of Islam, which is Zakat, or roughly translated in English as charity. Joining me on the program is Dr. Jamal Badawi of Saint Mary's University. As-salamu alaykum, Brother Jamal.
Wa alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
I'd like to go to the meaning of the term Zakat. I mentioned in my opening remarks that that could be roughly translated as being charity, but oftentimes when you read books that have been written by many people who are non-Muslim, there's different translations and different meanings that are assigned to this term Zakat. Sometimes, for example, they indicate that it's like a tithe, which you would be familiar to many of our viewers, I'm sure. Some suggest that it's a tax. Some say it's a religious tax. Some say that it's alms, some say charity, and so on. Are any of these words roughly equivalent to the term Zakat, or equivalent to the term Zakat?
Well, quite frankly, none of these terms really fully explain the original Islamic term Zakat.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know of any language that has the exact equivalent to this. The original or literal meaning of Zakat in Arabic means purity.
Purity.
Okay. For example, we find that in the Quran in chapter 9, verse 103, addressing the Prophet says, take from their property something to purify them and to sanctify them. This is the origin of the word. Some other related meaning also in Arabic to the term zakah means also blessing or growth and development.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, blessing, growth and development are also related to purification through the act of payment of zakah. In the legislative sense, in terms of the standard jurisprudence, zakah simply means the payment of a certain percentage of one's assets to the rightful beneficiaries as an act of love of God and expression of obedience and gratefulness to Him. Well, in this basic sense, I explained then, the terms that you refer to, some are quite erroneous, some are incomplete.
Mm-hmm.
An erroneous term that I'm familiar, as you mentioned, is mentioned quite frequently, tithe. It is not equivalent to tithe, because tithe, if you look into the dictionary definition, is the one-tenth of the produce of the land which is paid, especially in medieval times, to support the church and clergy. Whereas in Islam, zakah is not paid to support clergy or church, it's paid to support the poor. And in Islam also, you know that there's no institution of church as is understood in the, you know, Judeo-Christian tradition. The term tax is not appropriate either, because when you say tax, most people think of something that you've got to pay because you've got to, or else you'd be punished by law if you don't pay it. When you pay tax, you pay it also reluctantly. You try to seek every deduction that you could possibly get. You could try your best to avoid payment of tax whenever it's legal by claiming anything that you can. In the case of zakah, it is done essentially by the Muslim as an act of worship and love of God. So you don't do it reluctantly, you do it enthusiastically. Furthermore, in zakah also is different from tax, because zakah is determined by way of minimum, and the Muslim is encouraged and induced to pay more than that minimum.
Mm-hmm.
You never hear of that in tax. For example, if your tax return shows that you've got to pay $3,000, you don't say, all right, let me pay $3,500. You've never heard of that.
No.
But in Islamic... But in Islamic attitude of paying zakah as a worship of God, as an obedience, gratefulness to Him, many people actually say more than that. So in that sense, then, I would say that perhaps the term you used early, charity,
mm-hmm.
or alms, maybe charity is the closest meaning to expressing the meaning of the Bible. Because, for example, in Webster's dictionary, it says that charity means an act of love of God or fellow human beings. So it actually combines both of them. Maybe it was just one reservation. Most people, when you say charity, it gives the sense of something voluntary. You pay it or you don't pay it. It's all left up to you.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Islam, zakah is an obligatory duty on every Muslim. There is a minimum, but of course, there is no maximum for what you could possibly. As I said, perhaps charity is the closest meaning to that.
Mm-hmm. We always encounter difficulty when we try to translate things into language
perhaps,
but that's not the original. I'd like to ask you about the significance and the place of the zakat among the pillars that we've been discussing and will discuss in the programs to come. It comes third. We talked about the first two principles. It comes third. Is it followed under the third?
Right.
Yeah.
The way I interpret it, right, among the five pillars of Islam, after the testimony, the prayers, comes always zakat. And this is confirmed further in the Quran, when we find that zakah or charity has been combined or mentioned side by side with prayers in more than 80 verses, 80. Just to give you one example, in chapter 24, verse 56, it says, "So establish regular prayers and give regular charity and obey the messengers that you may receive mercy." The Quran also indicates that failure to pay this duty of charity towards fellow needy human beings earns the person the wrath and punishment of God in this life and in the hereafter. And this life could get a lot of blessings, suffering, and as well as the punishment in the hereafter. For example, in chapter 9 in the Quran, in verse 34, you find a very dramatic description of how people who are reluctant to pay zakah are punished in the day of judgment. It says that those who hoard gold and silver and spend it not in the way of God announce unto them a most grievous penalty. And then it goes on to describe that this metal that they used to cherish
mm-hmm.
will be heated, and then they will be marked or branded in their faces and their backs and their flanks. So it really gives a very terrible description
mm-hmm.
of the consequences of this miserliness and lack of gratefulness to God. On the other side, you find also the Quran is replete with quotations which encourages people to do this act of charity or zakah. Just to give you one or two examples, in the chapter 2 in the Quran, particularly verse 261 and on, it gives a vivid description as to how God rewards people manifold of what they spend by way of charity.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to this. The parable of those who spend of their sustenance or wealth in the way of God is like that of a grain of corn. It grows 7 ears, and each ear has 100 grains. God gives manifold or multiply rewards, increase to whom he pleases, and God cares for all, and he knows all things. So even one act of charity, you spend $1, God can reward you even 700 times as much as you have spent. And he even says, "I'm more." This is one. In describing the believers also on the day of judgment by way of their rewards in paradise, for example, in chapter 51 from verses 15 on, it gives us a vivid description of the enjoyment and felicity of believers, and then it relates to the reasons, one of which is the regular payment of the zakah. Let me recite that to you. As to the righteous, they will be in the midst of gardens and springs, taking joy in the things which their Lord gives unto them. Because before then, that's before the day of judgment,
mm-hmm.
Or while they're living on earth, they lived a good life, a righteous life. They were in a habit of sleeping but little at night because they spent part of it in worship. And in the hours of the early dawn, they were found praying for forgiveness. And, this is the part, in their wealth and possessions was remembered the right of the needy who asked, or those even who didn't ask. So in that sense then, above all, the payment of zakah or charity is an act of love of God, is an act of expression of the commitment or covenant to obey God and submit to his directions.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the, to get you to elaborate a little bit, when we were talking about the meaning, you said that zakah literally means charity. What do you mean? Could you explain what you mean when you say it literally means charity?
It means that we say that it purifies and purifies a number of meanings.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, it purifies your property or your assets. Because if this is a duty on you to pay, then it is not pure unless you pay what is due on it.
Mm-hmm.
It purifies your property to make it more blessed or legitimate or valid in the spiritual sense. Okay? Secondly, it purifies the heart of he or she who gives the cat, purify the heart from selfishness, greed, materialism,
mm-hmm.
lack of concern for fellow human beings. So that's another meaning also of purification. It also purifies the heart of the recipient of the cat, the poor.
Mm-hmm.
Purifies his heart from jealousy, from hatred against those who possess more and don't care for them. So by this kind of sharing, the act of love and sharing and mutual concern, humanitarian feelings, his heart also purified from jealousy. You can look at it even in a social level, and you can say also zakah is purification of society at large from class struggle and conflict, purification of society from social injustices, the system of economics or politics which allows the rich to become richer and the poor to become poorer,
mm-hmm.
almost like taxing the poor to pay the rich, all kinds of things. As an example of this, a medical doctor, for example, can deduct the transportation cost of his car and depreciation
mm-hmm.
as part of his business expense. But poor you and me
mm-hmm.
cannot do it, even though many people who are not earning as much are in more need to have this kind of deduction.
Some can't even afford to buy the car.
Exactly. Right. So this is one aspect to purify society from this kind of feelings of injustices and lack of concern for others. It purifies society as a result of this from any subversive ideology which finds a fertile ground when you have this kind of greed and lack of social justice in the system of economics or social system in general.
Mm-hmm. You touched lightly on the Islamic view of private ownership. I'm sure that you know this would be something that would be of interest to many of the people who are watching the program. Could you explain this view perhaps a little more, at least as it relates to the concept of the zakat that we're talking about?
No, you're referring to the social justice that I mentioned as it relates to how Islam views property.
Right.
Right. Well, to start with, Islam makes it clear, and we find abundant evidence of that in the Quran, that above all the universe, with all what it contains, belongs ultimately and exclusively to God. That is, God is the absolute sovereign owner and master of the universe. From this basic notion, it follows then that no human being, nobody, owns anything in the absolute and ultimate sense.
Mm-hmm.
According to the Quran, human beings are created to be the trustees of God on earth, to fulfill his will. It means then that God, out of his benevolence, even though he owns everything, has endowed us with these resources or this wealth to test us, to give it as a trust in our hands so that to see whether we can use this capability or wealth in the way that pleases him to save ourselves, our families, and humanity at large. In that sense, then, you find that the Quran sometimes talk about property as the domain of ownership of God. For example, in chapter 57, verse 6 says that those who believe in God and his messenger and spend in charity out of the substance whereof he has made you ears and trustees. He has given you. You don't really own it as such. But you find, however, that out of the grace of God, still we find in the Quran he uses the term your property, your wealth, to refer to human beings,
mm-hmm.
in order to give us a sense of dignity, to give us a sense of confidence in ourselves, to encourage us and motivate us. And it is natural, instinctive nature in all human beings that they want to work and get some reward for that work. They want to accumulate some kind of wealth. So the Quran also, on the other hand, uses the term your property. We find that, for example, in chapter 2, verses 262, and also in 188 in the same chapter. But something that's really fascinating in the Quran that even though God owns everything, when he asks us or commands us to spend part of that for the needy,
mm-hmm.
he calls that a loan.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine, he owns everything,
mm-hmm.
and then when we pay, he considers it like a loan from us to him. Of course, not in the literal sense, God doesn't need a loan from anyone.
Yeah.
You don't borrow what you own.
Mm-hmm.
But it just gives us this sweet feeling that you are dealing not just with human beings, not with governments or tax collectors, we're dealing with God himself, who is abundantly generous in terms of his rewards. Just to give you one quotation of this, to give the sense of it. In chapter 2, in verse 245, it says, "Who is he or she that will loan to God a beautiful loan, which God will double unto his credit and multiply many times?" And what could be a better deal than this? As we mentioned before, in the same chapter, chapter 2, it talks about multiplying 700 times or more. So this reflects the attitude of the Muslim, that neither does Islam condemn private ownership, nor does it tolerate a greedy type of economic system that crushes the poor and needy and that keeps the rich richer and the poor poorer, or at least stationary.
It's a very beautiful concept, the concept of being a trustee.
Right.
I think if people could keep that foremost in their mind, it might have a very profound impact in terms of how our relationship and some of the economic systems that are
present. It's a social responsibility.
Right, indeed. I'd like to ask you a series of short questions now relating to the system of zakat and its rules. I guess the one that would obviously come to most people's mind is who has to pay it. Here we talk about taxes, everybody must pay the taxes if we're a wage earner and so on. Mm-hmm. What about zakat? Who has to pay zakat?
Okay, zakat is due on every Muslim who owns something beyond his basic needs for a year, amounting to what is called nisab or more. Nisab was simply a minimum of extra beyond which a person is not required really to pay zakat.
Mm-hmm.
This nisab or minimum varies from time to time. It is estimated at the present time roughly between, let's say, $400 and $500. In other words, if you're a Muslim, you have something beyond your basic needs amounting to $400 or more, and you have that already for a year or more, then zakat is due on this extra, whichever.
Mm-hmm.
The extra or assets in general that you make to
get. When you say zakat is paid on one's assets, now does that mean that all of the assets that you own, for example, your house, would be taken into this calculation as well?
No, there are exemptions, just like we talk also about deductions,
mm-hmm.
legitimate deductions. Of course, first of all, you don't pay zakat on your basic needs, as I mentioned before, when you have like clothing at home or food that you're storing, you don't have to pay the account because these are basic needs. These are exempt. Secondly, your principal residence is also not the cashable. You don't have to pay the possible term. It's not the cashable. The tools of profession also is exempt from the cash because this is not wealth. This is a tool to help you earn money. Suppose you're a carpenter or whatever, and you have equipment, you know, craftsmen, that this is exempt. Some jurists also make analogy to that with the machinery. If you have a factory, you don't pay zakat on machinery if the machinery are used not to buy and sell, but machinery to produce goods and services. So this is also exempt. For women, their jewelry, particularly like, you know, gold, silver, others, is not also zakatable to the amount that is acceptable as a good norm or a reasonable norm for personal use, for adornment. But if those jewelry are used as saving, a method of saving, then it could be, or that amount would be zakatable. But if it's just for personal use, a reasonable amount, that's not subject to zakat. So this is, it doesn't mean that all assets, that everything from your garment to...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. More or less in the jargon of the day, you might say the luxuries, what we consider to be luxuries, over and above what would be our basic needs.
Right. Actually, like some jurists divided, they say zakat is due in terms of assets in basically four categories. One is the produce, that's the produce of the land.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, it's due also on cattle, and there is a whole detailed system, what kind of cattle, the age and so on,
mm-hmm.
and how much you pay out of each. It is also due on so-called articles of trade, like the inventory,
mm-hmm.
let's say, that you buying and selling in a year. and also on gold and silver. This has been a classic classification that you find in jurisprudence books. But of course today, instead of using gold and silver as coins, we are using money. So again, the same analogy applies to property that we have by way of money, like cash, savings in the bank, or even stocks that you buy, because that also could be analogous either to a saving or to a sort of investment which would fall under zakat on articles of trade.
Mm-hmm. What about the amount of zakat required now?
There's a big body of literature detailing all these issues. But to give it in a very brief and summary way, it ranges anywhere between 2.5% to 20% maximum. And that varies with the type of asset and the difficulty with which you acquire this asset.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a built-in system of equity and justice.
Mm-hmm.
Example. For money, for example, or savings, or gold, or silver, it's 2.5%.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? On land, or produce of land, it is 10% if the land is irrigated only by rain, so you're not spending so much investment or effort on that. It is 5% if you're using equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Irrigation
equipment.
Yeah. Like motors and all that. Some groups also said that if it is irrigated combined a little bit by machinery and a little bit by rain, then it could be 7.5%. Some groups even added that if it is just if it's using equipment and lots of effort and lots of expenditure that you have to put in, then it comes 2.5%. So it varies anywhere between 2.5% to 10%, depending on, again, the method.
Mm-hmm.
On treasure, suppose you walk the next day in some island and discover a treasure or something, or mine, without much effort. If you just face it like that, without much expenditure, then you pay 20% out of that. So it varies, like I said, but the most common, of course, is the 2.5%.
Mm-hmm.
Most common ones that most people look at in terms of cash value.
That's a, you shouldn't be really carrying along the parallel between the taxes that we normally are familiar with in Zakat, but right. Here, for example, we know that I think March 31st is the magic day when we must pay the IRS or the national
or else.
So what about Zakat? Is there any particular time when Zakat has to be paid?
Okay, the most common rule is that it should be paid at the end of every year. But there are exceptions to that. If, for example, the treasure that you should find, the treasure or mine,
mm-hmm.
then zakat on this would be due immediately after you find it, because you haven't spent much effort.
Mm-hmm.
Due immediately. On produce of land, the due date is the date of harvest, which is fair,
mm-hmm.
because you don't pay it before the harvest is ripe, and it might not really turn out to be good harvest.
Mm-hmm.
You pay it when it's ripe and ready.
Mm-hmm.
And in all other cases, you pay it at least once a year, so you find out how much did you have beyond your basic needs for a year, and then pay zakat on that. It is recommended, however, to pay zakat during the month of Ramadan, the month of fasting, or in propagation of the faith, or bringing its message to others in terms of education. And the final or eighth category in that chapter is the wayfarer who are stranded in foreign lands and don't have what is sufficient for them. And of course, it is recommended to give people who are in more need, and to start first by your own township or environment, going gradually out. Of course, for those who are living in places where there is a large degree of affluence, many jurists said that we could send or transfer this amount of charity to places where it is most needed, like places where there are lots of famines in the world today, and there are a lot more deserving than what you might find in an immediate vicinity, then you could do that.
Well, just before we close off this program dealing with zakat, there's an interesting hadith that we were chatting about before we started today's program. For those people perhaps who may not be in a position to be able to make a monetary or some other payment of zakat, one of the questions might share that saying of Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, about an act of charity.
And about what you should really...
About the smile.
Oh, yes. Actually, the word sadaqa, which is used also for zakat in the monetary sense,
right?
He says that when you smile in your brother's face, this is charity. When you ordain the good and forbid the evil, that's charity. When you remove something from the way of people that might hurt them, that's charity. When you help someone who is looking for a place and getting lost, that's charity. When you help someone who is blind or has bad sight, that is charity.
when you give out of the water that you have in your bucket and put in your brother's bucket, this is also an act of charity. So it's much more than just money.
Much more than just money. Well, thank you, Brother Jamal, for doing this program. We've exhausted our time for today. We want to invite you back to the Islam and Focus program next week, when we'll start another pillar on Islam. Thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum.
God, the beneficent, the merciful, the creator and the sustainer of the universe, peace and blessings upon his servant and messenger Muhammad forever. Ameen. I bear witness that there is no God but the one God, and I bear witness that Muhammad is the messenger and slave servant of God. I greet you with the greetings of all the prophets, from Abraham to Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, the universal greetings of peace, assalamu alaikum, which means peace be unto you. In today's program, we have our eighth program in the series dealing with the pillars of Islam. Today, we'll be talking about the fourth pillar of Islam, which is Siyam, or fasting. Today's program will be a repeat of a program that was taped earlier in our series of programs on Islam in Focus. We taped this program last year during the month of Ramadan, or fasting, and this program will be repeated today as part of our current series on the pillars of Islam. In today's program, we will talk about fasting and Ramadan and its significance for Muslims. My guest on today's program is Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Welcome to Islam in Focus, Jamal. Perhaps it might be helpful to the viewers of Islam in Focus if we start with some explanation of the month of Ramadan and its significance for Muslims.
Okay, one can perhaps refer to the Quran for a general answer to that question, then I'll make a comment on the verses. In chapter 2, verses 185 and 186, it says in translation, meaning Ramadan is the month in which was sent down the Quran as guide to mankind, also clear sign for guidance and judgment between right and wrong. So every one of you who is present during that month should spend it in fasting. But if anyone is ill or on a journey, the prescribed period should be made up by days later. God intends every facility for you. He does not want to put you to difficulties. He wants you to complete the prescribed period, that period of fasting, and to glorify Him, and that He has guided you, and perchance you shall be grateful. When my servants ask you, that is, ask you, O Muhammad, concerning me, I am indeed close to them. I listen to the prayers of every suppliant when he calls on me. Let them also, with a will, listen to my call and believe in me, that they may walk in the right way. And it is apparent from these two verses in the Quran that at least there are two basic elements in the significance of the month of fasting. One is basically historical, the other is mainly spiritual, moral.
Yes.
On the historical aspect, the month of Ramadan, which is the ninth month in the Islamic calendar, which follows the lunar year, is the month in which was revealed the Quran, the Islamic scripture, to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, when he was contemplating or meditating in the cave of Hira, outside of Mecca. That took place about 1400 years ago, so this is the year 1400 roughly. Now, the importance of the month of fasting is not only limited to Muslims, but it is a very essential event, a very important event in the history of the world at large, especially the history of prophethood.
Mm-hmm.
For the first time in history, God, Allah, chose to send a prophet, not to a particular tribe, not to a particular ethnic group, and not to a particular even town, but rather a universal prophet for all mankind, everywhere, and for all time to come. It is also significant in a sense that through that last prophet, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, God chose also to reveal his complete will, his complete guidance or way of life to mankind through a final scripture, not anymore to be changed and mixed with the philosophies and ideas of people, but rather an authentic scripture that until today is still available exactly in the same way it was revealed to Prophet Muhammad in the very original language in which it was revealed. As the Quran itself indicates, that the revelation of the Quran was very important in the history of mankind, because in a way it culminates the essential message that was preached by all prophets from Adam to Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and finally Muhammad in one final and complete scripture. It also corrects any misinterpretations or any mixing of the original scriptures given to previous prophets with ideas and philosophies that were alien to the faith, and bringing everything into complete form. In that sense, then, the revelation of the Quran represents an event for which not only Muslims but the entire world really should be thankful to God because of it. And that's why you find that the first verse I cited ends with the statement that you may glorify God that He has guided you. And I don't think that there's anything in this world that is worthy of being grateful for, that is worthy of giving thanksgiving or giving thanks for, than guidance, than being brought from the state of philosophical and theological riddle to the simple straightforward path of truth, the original truth of revelation. Nothing is better than getting from the darkness unto light, as the Quran calls it. The other aspect of Ramadan, as has been shown in the second verse I cited, is mainly spiritual in nature. In other words, in this verse, God talks about how close He is to mankind. How close is He to those who are earnest in seeking His guidance, who are earnest in praying to Him and trying to mold their lives in accordance with His will. In that sense, then, you can say that these are the two major elements, I should say, in the month of Ramadan.
Mm-hmm. I think perhaps the next logical question that would come into most people's minds is how fasting in the Muslim context is observed. What is it that observed, rather? What is it that Muslims are supposed to do during Ramadan or not supposed to do?
As a general rule, the month of fasting is observed by abstaining from all kinds of food, drink, smoking, and sex from dawn, which is approximately 75 to 90 minutes before sunrise, all the way up to sunset, which of course varies from season to season. And when we talk here about abstinence, we're talking about total and complete abstinence. Some of my Christian friends, for example, ask me, aren't you allowed to take water even during the day? Snack or something, just a little, or give up certain types of food? I said, no, this is not the type of fasting where you only give up some kind of food or the other. It's total absence, nothing really that gets into your stomach for the whole period between dawn and sunset. In addition, or in return, I should say, for this total abstinence, there is no restriction, however, on any type of food or drink, so long as it's permissible. For example, does not include alcoholics or other things which are forbidden in Ramadan and other than Ramadan too. Every kind of food and drink that's local are permitted between sunset and dawn. In other words, for the whole night until the very break of the day. If there's any restriction, however, it is only the restriction of common sense and avoidance of indulgence, so that people would not just make up for the hunger during the day by overeating after sunset, because this is certainly is contrary to the Islamic teaching about even the question of partaking food, and contrary to the whole wisdom and benefit that one derives from fasting, and that's to learn some sort of self-control.
Some people in this country particularly are confused by the fact that Ramadan comes in different months and different seasons according to the common calendar here. Can you explain the reason for this, why Ramadan moves from one time in the month to another month?
Okay. The reason for that is that, as it was indicated before, the month of Ramadan is an Islamic month, so it follows the Islamic calendar.
Yes.
The Islamic calendar follows the lunar year. And as you know, in the lunar year, every month is about 29 and a half days.
Yes.
I think 29 79.503, something like that.
That's around that after 30 days. That's still 30 days for that.
Right, that's close to 30 days.
Yeah. Math, yeah.
But when you circle it up, the lunar years comes to about 10 or 11 days shorter than the solar year.
Yeah.
This means then that every year, the month of fasting, the month of Ramadan, comes about 10 or 11 days earlier than the previous year.
Right.
So, for example, this year, if Ramadan started on July 13th, next year it would start, for example, around July 3rd, for example. The following year would be in late June, and so on. And this way, Ramadan keeps rotating in different seasons and different months, the months as defined in the Western or common calendar, the solar year. In a way, you could say that it is advantageous. If all fasting occurs in December, for example, it means then that every time you're fasting only for about 11 hours between dawn to sunset. If it all occurs in July, it means that you're fasting perhaps between 16 to 18 hours. But by rotating the month of Ramadan to the different seasons and different months, the Muslim experience discipline of fasting under all kind of conditions in all kind of seasons.
Right. Well, you just told us that during the month of fasting, it's not permissible to eat from dawn to sunset.
Right.
What about the case of people living in places like Scandinavia or near the poles, where we have sometimes months of continuous sunshine, or on the other hand, months of continuous darkness? What about how would they observe the fast?
The Islamic law, by its very nature, has endless adaptability and flexibility in application to particular situations like this one.
Mm-hmm.
And that question has been addressed by Muslim Jews. Of course, you could not say to those people, you could not fast, or you could not break your fast in the times when it's all day, because the night never comes for quite a few weeks, sometimes for months. And it means also that in the period of the year where it's all dark, that they will not be able to fast at all, which is because both of them are unreasonable and both of them are contradicted to another aspect of Islamic law, and that is you should not fast continuously. In other words, you have to break your fast sometimes every day. You can't just eat for 3 or 4 days without food or drink. So the solution for those people is that either they could fast a number of hours which is equivalent to the number of hours fasted by people who are close to them in the nearest moderate area,
mm-hmm.
or they could fast a number of hours similar, for example, to the hours fasted in Mecca,
mm-hmm.
being the place where the Quran first was given.
Yeah.
So there's no problem in solving that problem, because even those mm-hmm. people living in this area, they have some system of adjusting their working hours and sleeping hours, so you can still make some kind of approximation, and their fasting would be acceptable.
Right. Now, this fasting, is it compulsory on all Muslims, irrespective of age? And so on, is it a requirement that all Muslims must participate in the fast? For example, children, young children required to
no.
participate in the fast?
The general rule in fasting as a religious obligation is that it is prescribed on every Muslim, male or female, who have already reached the age of adolescence, that is when the person reaches the age of puberty.
Mm-hmm.
Since fasting is an act that requires a fair amount of discipline and sacrifice, if you will, it is desirable that even though for small children who are not required to fast, to start training them gradually to get used to fasting. For example, in many Muslim countries, and even in places like in Canada and US, those who have children, the children usually start, let's say, by fasting from dawn to noon, let's say, or from breakfast to lunch.
Yes.
At least to make sure that they not take snacks in the middle. That gets them somewhat used to it. As the child grows up and becomes stronger and gets more interested in fasting, he might try, for example, fasting a full day, maybe a few days, and then the following year he can increase the number of days he fasts. That's how most Muslims in Muslim countries get to learn or practice the fasting. But this should be done, however, with motivation and encouragement rather than pressure. My personal experience as a father Sometimes my children are the ones who are asking for, Daddy, would you wake us early in the morning? They get so excited.
Actually, you're talking about Muhammad before we began today's program, and I think you're telling me that he is fasted 8 days.
Exactly. He's 9 years old.
Yes.
And some people even start before that. There are other children in the community who have fasted more than Muhammad did, even about perhaps half or more than half of the days during this month. They get so excited about it, and they really feel a challenge and are proud of it. But one should not pressure small children to fast for the whole month. By the time they reach the age of adolescence, it becomes just normal for them to fast.
Right. Other than small children, are there other exemptions, other individuals that are exempted from, or other conditions which will exempt people from participating in the fast?
Yes, there are. In fact, there are some exemptions which are temporary in nature, others that are permanent. An example of the temporary exemptions are people, for example, who are ill or sick, where the fasting might either aggravate the illness or delay their cure, because it's not one of the objectives of Islamic law to put people into greater difficulty, like the verse I cited, that God does not wish to place us in great difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, discipline, yes, but not in a difficulty in such a way that it endangers the life or the health of the individual. So the sick person may not fast until he is cured, and then he can make up for the missed days in a later time. Obviously, another aspect of the compassionate teaching also of the Quran is that for women, for example, who are during their monthly cycle, where they probably feel a little weaker or tired, also women who are pregnant, women immediately after childbirth during the postnatal rest, and also mothers who are breastfeeding their children, their infants. For these categories, they are also not required to fast, again, provided that they can make up for the days they have missed in a later time when the reason for the exemption has been removed. As far as the permanent exemptions, this applies to people who would not be able in the future even to make up for the missed days of fasting. An example of this would be a very old person, where you don't expect him to become younger again, so just keep getting older and weaker. If there's such case, a person may make a substitute for fasting if he's able to financially by providing two meals for a poor person for every day that he missed during the month of fasting. So a total, let's say, of 60 meals, 60 average meals for every year that he misses the month of fasting. A similar situation applies to a person who is chronically ill, who's not expected to get over that illness, even if he's young, where fasting could be harmful to his health. He can also make the same kind of substitution since he has no way of doing it.
Even for those people who are reasonably healthy, it seems that fasting is quite a challenge. I know many of my non-Muslim friends have find it quite difficult to imagine how a person could go without any food or any drink from dawn to sunset. I mean, in some other fasting, in Lent, for example, there's certain kinds of food that you don't eat, but you are able to eat some food at least. But in the Islamic fast, there's no food or drink from dawn to sunset. And many people find it very difficult to accept. What would be your response? How would you respond to a person who was puzzled in this?
Maybe they should try it.
Really?
Yes. If you try it, it might feel a little difficult and hard at the beginning, but once you get used to it, even those who are keeping the fast year after year, usually the first 3 or 4 days of the month of Ramadan might be a little difficult. You have to give up some of the bad habits like smoking, for example, and taking too much coffee or something like that. So it gets a little hard at the very beginning. But as the system adjusts to the fast, it's not really that hard. It is of course, it requires lots of discipline. There's no question about that. It's not that easy as other types of fasting, for example, that you mentioned. But it is not really impossible or unreasonable. There are a number of reasons why it is not unreasonable. First of all, you're permitted, as I indicated before, to eat whatever you like or drink between sunset and dawn.
Yes.
So if you wake up as late as possible, as close as possible to dawn time, which, like I said, about 75 minutes roughly before sunrise, and have a meal, that could really help you sustain you for the rest of the day. And then you can break your fast immediately after sunset. You don't have to wait after sunset. And but the key issue, really, or the key point in getting the training for fasting is the early training. Once the person really starts gradually, little by little, he gets used to it and actually gets pleasure out of doing it.
Sometimes we're amazed at what our systems can, you know, we tend to spoil our systems, particularly when it comes to eating. Sometimes we consume fast more in the run of a day than that system really requires to sustain itself.
Sometimes we undermine how adaptable our system is to all kinds of environmental conditions and fasting or not fasting. But we have to have the courage to try it.
Right. Let me ask you another question on a related point. Sometimes we hear in the media that because of Ramadan, particularly in the countries of the Middle East and other Muslim countries, that everything comes to a standstill in Ramadan, that offices are closed, businesses are closed, and life more or less just stops for that month of fasting. How accurate are these reports?
Well, I think it's grossly exaggerated, I should say. There's no doubt, to start with, that for a person to observe the fast, it may result in some cases to some slight slowdown in the way business or other functions are performed, especially if the month of Ramadan falls during the hot and long days of the summer. There's no question about that. But like I said, it's grossly exaggerated to say that everything really comes to a standstill. I happen to have been born and brought up in my early life in the Middle East, so at least I can speak with some first-hand experience or familiarity. What happens there, in fact, is that in government offices or in companies or other establishments, the employees may be permitted to work maybe 1 to 2 hours less every day. Especially those who wake up late at night in order to observe the prayers and so on. So they may have this kind of concession during Ramadan. It varies between 1 to 2 hours less per day. Sometimes even it's just an adjustment of the working hours, like starting a little early and going home earlier so that you can have a nap in the afternoon and rest before it gets really too hot and too difficult at work. As far as business, it goes on as usual. The main sector that is affected, at least superficially, look like being affected, is the sector of restaurants. In a country where the majority are Muslims and are observing the fast, you would not expect too many restaurants.
You wouldn't do any business.
Exactly. You wouldn't do many business. Of course, some might be open for non-Muslim visitors or others in some countries, but it doesn't mean that you have really full strength. But even in this case, the business more than pick up after sunset.
Right.
The restaurants start opening shortly before sunset, so people want to buy food or just go there to break the fast. And usually they have extended hours that sometimes goes into the early hours of the morning. So it's simply, again, readjustment of the business hours rather than simply bringing everything to a halt. And many people just keep talking about places where Muslims are in majority, numerically. But how about the millions of Muslims who are in Europe, in the United States, in Canada? This program has all been prepared during the month of fasting. The program is being recorded while both the guest and the speaker, the guest and the host are fasting. Personally, as an individual, I have gone through all kinds of experiences while fasting, going to work, teach, prepare for exams and everything, without much difficulty.
So life more or less continues as normal, accepting that there are the special observances that are required of Muslims during the Ramadan. In the 5 minutes that we have remaining on the program, I'd like to touch on a couple of other aspects of fasting. We talked a little bit about the significance of fasting in our opening question, but let's come back to this question of significance again, just to have you perhaps develop this point a little bit more specifically. What is the significance of fasting as a religious duty for Muslims?
Well, as a religious duty, fasting above all is an act of worship. It's an act of submission and obedience to the will of God. It's a kind of dedication and commitment of one's life to the commandments of God. This helps translate the divine love or the love of God to take it beyond a slogan into an actual practice and an actual sacrifice by giving up the local things even during the month of Ramadan in obedience to that. If there is nothing in fasting but this, it will suffice. But in addition, we find that there is also a very important moral lesson that's learned from fasting. During the month of fasting, we give up lawful things, even the food and drink and things that are permitted, we voluntarily limit or restrain ourselves during the day from doing these things. If one did that training, he is more likely to overcome the temptation to commit unlawful acts outside of Ramadan or during Ramadan itself. That's why one verse in the Quran in 2:183 says that fasting has been prescribed on you as it has been prescribed on those before you, in order that you may learn to be God conscious, to be mindful of God, or to learn self-restraint. In addition to this, we find that fasting teaches other moral virtues. As the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was quoted in one hadith, which is a prophetic saying as narrated in Bukhari. He says that whoever does not refrain or abstain from falsehood in words and deeds, God has no need for him to give up his food and drink. Which means fasting is not just to stop eating and drinking, you have to stop or to teach yourself also to be also virtuous in other respects also in life. In addition, Ramadan also, the month of fasting, is a chance for the person to rededicate his life, to atone or ask forgiveness from God for his previous sins and mistakes. That's why the Prophet of Islam says in one of his sayings, as narrated in Ahmad, whoever fasts Ramadan with faith or out of faith and in the pursuit of God's pleasure, his previous sins will all be forgiven. So in a sense then, fasting is a form of jihad or struggle, as we had in a previous program, struggle against the domination of our low desires and their hold on us. In a way, you could say that fasting is an annual spiritual overhaul, if you will.
Yes. In the 2 minutes that we have remaining, Brother Jamal, I wonder if you could tell us what happens after the month of fasting is over. Is there any celebration? And if so, are there any local activities that take place here in the Muslim community?
Okay, one important aspect of fasting that relates to the answer to that question is the social aspect, because in Islam, again, fasting is not only just an individual or spiritual act, it also has social ramifications, because Islam does not make a distinction between secular and religious. They're all intermingled. And that is when you fast, you practice the actual feeling of hunger, so you feel more compassion towards the poor and needy. I could tell you, or talk as long as I want on how does it feel to be hungry, but when you are hungry, then it feels differently.
Yes.
So that's why both during the month of Ramadan and immediately after it ends, one of the greatest celebrations really is this compassion to the poor. That's why the charity immediately after Ramadan is required to be given to the poor. The regular charity, other than the Ramadan charity, is encouraged also to be paid during the month of fasting. It is also desirable in the morning immediately after the end of the month of fasting, which is the first day of the following month after Ramadan. A Muslim is encouraged to wake up in the morning, early in the morning, take a shower, put his best clothes, usually new clothes, especially for the children who have the new clothes on that day. Go to the mosque for the congregational prayer, chanting glorification and thanksgiving to God, followed by prayers and then a short speech to be given on the occasion. And then after that, people can go home and visit their friends and relatives, exchange gifts, and try to celebrate and give thanks for being able to observe the month.
Thank you, Brother Jamal, for being on our program today. And we've exhausted our time. For viewers who may want to have more information on fasting, free booklet on fasting is available from the Islam and Focus program. You can get this booklet by writing to Islam and Focus, care of Post Office Box 162, Gaffney. That's our program for today. Thank you for watching Islam and Focus.